Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Leadership Focus, an internet radio show geared to everyday leadership, both at work and throughout your life. Each week, we present you with new ideas, interesting guests, and actionable strategies to help you be an incredible leader with a more balanced life. I'm your host, Lisa Pospyorek, Executive Coach and CEO of Focus Coaching, a leadership coaching and training firm based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Tonight, our topic is, can you teach yourself to be wiser? And our guest tonight is professor and researcher from the University of Michigan, Ethan Cross. Dr. Cross is Columbia educated and both an esteemed researcher and the director of the University of Michigan's Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory. His work has been funded by the National Science Foundation, the National Institute of Mental Health, and the John Templeton Foundation. And it has been published many times in leading scientific journals and popular press. His current work focuses on what happens when people work through negative feelings and the ways people cope in everyday life. We are fortunate to have him here tonight to tell us about some of his latest findings and most intriguing research. Welcome, Dr. Cross.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you here. Thanks for being with us tonight. So, Ethan, it's great to have you. I've read a fair amount of your research, and you've done some very interesting stuff. To start out, tell me how you got hooked on psychology and particularly psychological research.
It happened when I was an undergraduate in college and when I was taking an intro class in psychology and was exposed to two sets of ideas that just seemed to butt heads with one another. Both ideas dealt with the issue of bad things happen, and it's often the case that when we experience negative events, we don't just, experience them and move on. They often linger. We think about them after they've happened. And I was intrigued about the question of, well, how can people deal with those kinds of everyday aversive experiences? And on the one hand, I came across lots of examples of studies in the textbooks and in lectures which suggested that if you want to have a person cope adaptively with a negative experience, what you want to do is help them think differently about it. In other words, find some meaning in the event or rethink it, right? Think differently about it so that it no longer bothers you. That doesn't mean excusing bad behavior, but just reinterpret it in a way that you nip it in the bud. And that made a lot of sense. Then on the other hand, I came across studies showing that when people try to do that, it often makes them feel worse. So in other words, if something bad happens to you and you focus your attention on trying to understand why it happened to you, so let me try to get to the bottom of this to figure out why I really feel this way, 9 times out of 10, that ends up perpetuating that negative state that that you're experiencing. So I just found that puzzle really, really intriguing. And to me, the question of interest became, well, what's the difference between adaptive ways of thinking about past experiences and more harmful ways? How can you help a person work through a negative experience rather than worry or ruminate about it endlessly in ways that lead them to be distressed, miserable, their partner's miserable, and so forth? So that's really what got me hooked on psychology, and I've been trying to answer that question as well as lots of other ones that have sprung up along the way ever since.
How interesting. You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking about more traditional, I have a background as a therapist before I went into coaching, more traditional therapy where you go over negative events and over negative events. And, of course, how that may be counterproductive. And then less traditional methods. I used to use toward the end of my career as working primarily as a psychotherapist, solution focus, where you get just enough of what happened to know what happened, and then you work on what the exceptions are, when things are better, you know, how are they better, and how can you do more of that, and really moving into the present.
Yeah, and you know, from our studies, I mean, that's consistent with what we found in multiple laboratory experiments. What we find to be the trick, if you will, for helping people think in a healthy way about their experiences in ways that allow them to move on is this concept of psychological distance. So the idea, to give you an example of what I mean by distance, is Lisa, have you ever had the experience of a friend coming to you with a problem and they're just overwhelmed with distress? Maybe it's anxiety, maybe it's depression, and they come to you and explain the situation to you, and it's relatively easy for you to coach them through that situation. Have you ever had, I mean, I think your title probably implies that you're doing this. So it's,
well,
kind of a rhetorical question.
Not only my 20 years as a therapist, but, you know, from the time I was about 12 years old, Ethan, people would say to me, Lisa, I've never been able to talk to anybody about this before. You're
right.
So easy to talk to. So, yes, I've had that experience many times.
Well, I think this experience is, I guess that you might have.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that this experience is common. When we're not in mm-hmm. the situation, when our emotions aren't running high, we can think very objectively about things. But when the emotions, when the amplitude of the emotion really goes up, our ability to think reasonably, rationally, without catastrophizing or making the worst out of things, seems to go out the window. So what we've tried to look at in the laboratory are ways of getting people to think about their own emotional experiences from a more distanced or detached perspective, so as to essentially help a person think about their own problems as though they were coaching a friend through the same kind of situation. And we found this kind of distancing strategy to be enormously effective at helping people cope with a range of negative experiences. So just to give you a few concrete examples, if we bring people into the lab and have them think about a really distressing emotional experience, a time when they were rejected by the person they loved and, you know, thought mm-hmm. they were married, for example. When we have people try to work through that event from this more distanced perspective, what we find is that reduces how distressed they report feeling subjectively, it reduces how aroused they are physiologically, so how high up their blood pressure goes when they think about this experience. It leads them to think about these experiences less over time, so intrusive thoughts aren't gnawing away over and over and over again, and so forth and so on. So we really do find this distancing strategy to be helpful, and what we've begun to do in some of our more recent work is apply some of the insights from this work we've done on coping and emotion regulation to the context of emotional intelligence and wisdom and things of that sort.
Hmm. How interesting. Yeah. You know, often the they're essentially creating perspective instead
yeah.
of having another person be the person with perspective. They're creating perspective. And I do that sometimes with clients. I'll say, you know, if you were coaching someone through this, what would you tell someone?
That's right.
And then they kind of go, oh, and they come up with all these smart ideas when they were stumped before.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very basic mental shift, but I think it's a really powerful one. There's something very powerful about being able to talk to someone else about your problems who's not undergoing the same problem. It can actually, there's actually work showing that if you talk to someone else about a problem and if they're experiencing that problem as well, that can be quite harmful, actually. That can lead to something called co-rumination, or communal worrying, if you will. But talking to someone who's not in that situation can really give you perspective. So wouldn't it be great if you had the capacity to do that for yourself when you don't have that other person around?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think about support groups and the times that I've known people have said, I can't go back to that support group. It just makes me feel worse. And if that's the co-rumination thing going on, that people are just going into the downward spiral together instead of bringing each other up.
Right, right. I mean, it can be unconstructive to just lament and brood over that experience. So that's not what we find to be. You know, we in fact find that it can be harmful to just ask people to describe what happened in the way that you were describing in your earlier example, Lisa, that you found it to be not particularly helpful in therapy to have people just recount their emotions and their experiences, mm-hmm. but just tell you enough about that experience so that you can quickly get them to problem solve and work through. And we find something similar. What we find distancing to be really useful for is allowing people to make that shift into problem-solving mode. It can be really difficult to get into that problem-solving frame of mind when people are immersed in their experiences.
So how do you teach them to do it?
Well, I should say that in all of our experiments, we've done what we call simple laboratory manipulation. So we have instructions that we give people in the lab under controlled conditions to think about their experiences in these particular ways, distance or immersed. We haven't actually trained people to do this in their everyday lives over time. We're currently doing some of that training work, and we're really excited about it. But in the laboratory studies that we've done, we've looked at two strategies, one much more than the other. The main strategy we've used is we ask people to think about their past experiences in our studies. So recall a time from your past or relatively recent past in which you felt overwhelming feelings of anger and hostility or depression or anxiety. And people report having mental imagery. Most people see a picture of that scene or that experience when they think about it. That's very common. And what we do is we play around with the visual imagery. So in the immersed condition, which is really, I think, the natural condition, the natural way that people think about these past experiences, what we do is we ask people to replay that event happening to them, to themselves, all over again through their own eyes, as though you're right there. And then from that perspective, we ask people to problem solve. We say, try to understand your feelings. What were the underlying cause and reasons for, why you felt the way you did? In the distancing condition, what we do is we tell people to take a step back and essentially adopt the perspective of a fly on the wall. So take a step back to a point where you can actually see yourself in that experience, interacting with those other people, if other people happen to be there. And while you look at yourself from this distance perspective, try to understand why your distant self, that person over there, why is he feeling the way that he or she is? So we actually have people think about themselves as though they were someone else. It's no longer why am I, it's why is he or she. And that, in a nutshell, is how we manipulate the distancing and what leads to the effects we've observed.
How interesting. So how do you measure this stuff? You know, you were talking about how it leads to decreased rumination, which is, of course, a big, big problem for a lot of people, that they will beat themselves up over and over again about negative experiences.
Yeah, and in ways that I think can interfere with every facet of one's life, from one's relationships to work to sleep.
Yeah. So how do you measure whether or not they're doing that? And how long does the effect last, and is it temporary, permanent? Do you have any information about that?
Sure. Great questions. We typically employ what we call a multi-method approach, which is we use lots of different measures to triangulate the kinds of effects that distancing is having on people, or whatever strategy we happen to focus on. One thing we do in all of our studies is ask people how they're feeling after they engage in this experiment. And I think that's a really important question, because I think people can communicate to you if they're feeling overly angry or overly anxious versus not. So that's one type of measure we use. Another kind of measure we use is our physiological measures of various sorts. So in a few studies, we've hooked people up to blood pressure machines that continuously record their blood pressure as they go through the study. And what we find is that one of the things that's established is when people think about angry experiences, it doesn't just make them feel bad subjectively. It actually causes their blood pressure levels to go up. That's not in and of itself bad. What can get really bad from a health point of view is when your blood pressure levels go up and stay up chronically over time. And there's some research showing that rumination actually does that, because you're continually thinking about how this other person insulted you. So you're continually getting upset about this, and you remain aroused in this way chronically. And what we see in studies that have looked at blood pressure is that distancing leads to smaller increases in blood pressure when people think about these experiences, but importantly allows people to recover physiologically a lot more quickly. So whereas people who would normally think about these events, whereas their blood pressure levels would remain elevated for periods of time past the end of the experiment, the purported end of the experiment, that's not the case for the distancers. So that's another measure we've used. We've done brain scans with people, showing reductions in brain regions that track with emotion, negative emotion, and a few other kinds of more indirect measures.
So you're getting self-report, you're getting physiological stuff with BPs, and you're doing, when you're talking brain scans, you're talking MRIs then?
That's right. Right. MRIs, and we have people think about negative experiences in these different ways, and then we look at how different networks of brain regions respond to instructions, to these different sets of instructions. And what we see in the brain scan studies, or study singular, is you get reduced activity in a network of regions that are involved in thinking about the self and self, thinking about oneself and experiences that are relevant to the self when you distance. So it really is, you see a reduction in the brain regions that support the question of why am I feeling this way, if that makes sense. Is that clear?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense to me. Really interesting stuff. So what do you know about the sustainability of that effect? Can people, you know, do that a few times and get good at it, or is it something that they need to really practice and work at?
Right. I you caught me. I forgot to answer the second part of your previous question.
That's okay. I asked a multi-phase question there. So
okay. Yeah. No, that's helpful. Well, we do know that there are some lingering or delayed effects. So we've shown, for example, with a really simple laboratory procedure. So just think about a negative experience, distance while you try to make sense of it versus not. The people who distance report over the course of 7 days after the study experiencing fewer intrusive thoughts about their negative experience. So they actually are ruminating about it less over time. And we also know that if we bring them back to the lab a week after the experiment and we just remind them of the negative event, they become less distressed. And that's really important from our perspective. The real-world analog is someone has just broken your heart and you're torn up about it. You work through the experience so that when you bump into that person a week later, that doesn't reactivate all of these negative emotions that lead you to become bedridden again or really angry, right? We've really dealt with the source of the problem so that you can interact with this individual in the future. We're finding that at least a week after the experiment, we see that kind of effect of distancing. Beyond a week, we don't have data on these manipulations. One of the things we're doing now is actually training people using a fairly intensive protocol for really teaching people how to do this in daily life. And what we're doing as part of this study is looking to see how it influences people, not just in the short term, but really over time, across lots of different types of measures. So that's one way we're trying to address this question that you raised. The other interesting set of findings that we have concerns people who do this naturally. Turns out this isn't something that's just, you know, artificially created. We've created this strategy and we can tell people how to do it. Some people naturally or spontaneously distance when they think about distressing experiences. And we've shown in a set of studies that people who spontaneously engage in this process or strategy, they show the exact same kinds of benefits as people who are told to do it in the lab do in their daily lives. So there's some evidence of this actually panning out in daily life spontaneously too.
So you have any sense of what percentage of people spontaneously do this? I mean, is it like a tiny percentage or 10%?
That's a great question. I don't know offhand. Someone else has asked me this, and I dug up the answer, but it escapes me right now. So I don't know.
You know, and I'm wondering also if that's spontaneous, you know, that's brain chemistry, or if that is, of course, these are intertwined, or if that's learned, you know, those thought patterns are learned.
Yeah.
You know, from a family background that says to their child when something bad happens, says whatever they say that helps them to create that internal dialogue that distances for them.
Well, this is a fascinating question, actually, and it's something that we're working on right now. It has come up before. How does this develop? And as a new dad, I can tell you that one of the more striking things I've noticed in my own life is me talking to my daughter about myself in the third person. So that daddy doesn't like that, Maya. Don't do that. That's not nice. Or daddy does like this. For a child, and you know, this isn't just the distancing, you know, researcher doing this. I've asked friends who are in all sorts of industries. Turns out this kind of third person self talk is fairly common. So, if that is common, that's being modeled for a child at a very young age. And I think it's a really interesting question. There is one caveat I want to convey about the spontaneous distancing. We don't think that there are people who are spontaneous self-distancers or people who just do this across the board. It's likely to be situation dependent. So I may be really good at distancing when I get into an argument with a family member, but less good at distancing when I get into an argument with a colleague, or maybe it works vice versa. So I think it's more complicated than just pigeonholing people into one type or another. There are likely different kinds of profiles at work in daily life that I think figuring out is a really interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that is interesting. Like in what kinds of situations or with what kind of emotion. Yeah.
Exactly. We all know we all have a friend or a boss or a colleague who's able to deal with any problem under the sun at work, but when they deal with a personal issue, they crumble. Right? That's a profile. That's showing that you can be really good at one kind of skill in one domain, but really bad at implementing the same skill in another. And I think the same is probably true for distancing, in that we all have our own triggers that really make it difficult to distance on our own. And if we can identify what those triggers are for ourselves, you know, that might be informative for knowing when to go talk to a friend or coach or whomever, because there might be limits of as to our own ability to deal with that situation. So that's another interesting thing we often talk about in the lab and try to figure out how to address.
Yeah, I've done work for many, many years with physicians,
mm-hmm.
and other really high-level people, you know, senior executives, that kind of thing. And, of course, they're supposed to know everything
mm-hmm.
and not need help. And one of my early tasks is to explain to them that, you know, you can be brilliant, but if it's about you, you don't often have the perspective to see it as effectively, and that I can help them with the perspective. So it's.
I mean, that's a wonderful
yeah.
way of summarizing actually the motivation behind much of what we do. I think that is exactly the phenomenon that we try to address. Not to say that you'll always be able to self-help, if you will, or help yourself with these distancing strategies. I think you want to avail yourself of the rich social network that surrounds you and the resources that different people can provide. It's a wonderful thing about being human. We have these resources. But we think there's some room to play around with respect to empowering people to bring some of that perspective taking to themselves and have helping people initiate that process on their own. And that's what we're trying to figure out how to do. How far can we push this? You know, to what extent can we really get a person to really go through life in a way that they can strategically take the perspective when they need it to help them? Those are some of the questions we're interested in.
It's really exciting work. I would love to hear more about your research as it progresses. Really exciting. It can make a huge difference in a lot of people's lives and in their happiness.
We hope so. So we think we're at the early stages, but we're, you know, this is a lot of fun, so it'd be fun to come back
yeah.
and chat some more again.
Well, we just have a couple minutes left, and I want to ask you really quickly, because we're almost out of time, how people can get more information, if they want to read more, if they want to know more. Is there some place you would direct them to?
Yes. I have a website for my lab, and
right.
on that website, the best way to find it, because it's a long address, is to just Google my name, Ethan Cross, or Michigan Self-Control Lab. And on the website, there are, all of our published papers are listed, along with press coverage of some of that work, which distills it and strips away the sometimes technical jargon to give
mm-hmm.
summaries.
Oh, it does.
And I think it's great for that reason. So
makes it very accessible to everybody. Yeah.
Yeah, and we do want to communicate it. So.
So it's,
and feel free to email
Ethan
me.
Ethan Cross. It's Cross for people
yeah.
that are listening and not looking at the write up, so they could find it that way.
Yes.
Okay. Great. Well, is there one piece of information that you'd like to leave, or one thought that you'd like to leave with our audience?
Yes. The parting thought is, when you're feeling completely immersed and overwhelmed, know that you do have the potential to take a step back and think about that experience more objectively. It might take a few stabs at doing it. There are times when you might need to talk to someone else, but I think many of us have the potential to do it, and if we can engage in that process, we can feel better.
Excellent. Thanks, Ethan.
Thanks so much, Lisa.
Thank you for joining us tonight on the Leadership Focus, the show which gives you new ideas, interesting guests, and actionable strategies to help you be an incredible leader with a more balanced life. We hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have, please go to blogtalkradio.com and become a friend.
and make us a favorite. To sign up for our free newsletter with more tips and strategies you can use, go to focuscoaching.net on the web. That's focuscoaching.net on the web. Until next time, this is your host, Lisa Pospiel, urging you to be a better leader every day.